You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, July 1st, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, professor of history at the New School, Federico Finkelstein, on a brief history of fascist lies. Meanwhile, 45,000 new cases, nearly 130,000 dead. The U.S. seven-day new cases has doubled since June 13th. And our federal government's response is virtually nil. Oklahomans, however, vote to expand Medicaid to 200,000 people in their state, under the auspices of the Affordable Care Act. And in Colorado, a QAnon supporter beats a five-term congressman, Republican congressman, in a GOP primary in what is a Coloradan swing state. Swing district. Speaking of Colorado, Hickenlooper wins. That stinks. The Senate extends the Paycheck Protection Program. Democrats unveil an ambitious but not quite Green New Deal. Trump threatens veto of a defense bill over Confederate named bases. And without emergency funding, our entire immigration system is going to shut down within a month or two. Republican Senate strips a provision from an intel bill requiring campaigns to report foreign election help. That's weird. And a federal court decides that Trump administration's third country asylum rule is invalid. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us. It's hump day. We've made it to another Wednesday, ladies and gentlemen, and I hope you are you're doing well in certain parts of the country. Things are getting a little bit terrifying. I think there are two states in the country where numbers have gone down today, and it was, I believe it's Connecticut and Rhode Island, oddly enough. Not sure what it is about those two states. But and of course, in places like Arizona and Texas and Florida, California, seeing explosive growth in the infections. We are not there yet in terms of deaths. Hopefully we'll never get there in terms of a commensurate amount of deaths. But remember, when we get a report that the seven-day new cases has doubled since June 13th, okay? So we're talking 3 weeks ago. These people were infected 3 weeks ago. And so deaths are a little bit of a lagging indicator, but we are outside of the window of where we would see more deaths. It really is a function of the age of people who are getting the COVID-19. A reminder, and I think I've heard that there's more Facebook groups that are being created for folks who have recovered from COVID-19 to talk about their medical problems that they're having. Significant medical problems that people have that could theoretically plague them the rest of their life. But at one point, the average age could, not necessarily, but I would say likely, go from 36, which it is now in these outbreaks that we're seeing in places like Texas and Arizona and Florida. And if it gets up to like in the mid 40s, then we're going to have a severe problem, I think, in terms of fatalities. We're also, there's the potential of problem when it comes to fatalities. If the capacity of our medical system is overrun. So wear a mask. Apparently, Republican leaders now are circling back around to the idea of wearing a mask. It protects those around you. I think it probably protects you to some degree, maybe even more than we know, even if it's a non-N95 mask, but it certainly protects other people. And just to be clear, this is because those droplets that come out of your mouth when you talk, they go into the air. Some hit the ground, some evaporate and aerolize, and those are the ones that can be very problematic for other people. Certainly a droplet, if it lands in your face, it will be. But it's the aerolization of these droplets. When you block them with a mask, and you don't know, maybe you're asymptomatic, you're limiting the number of the amount of aerolization of these droplets that are in the air. And so it's harder for people to catch. That's just basically it. One would imagine that 4 months into this, everybody would know this, but they don't, because our federal government did not marshal any of they didn't bother to marshal any of the resources that we have in this country to deal with it. So, all right, let's go with this. Joe Biden's numbers continue to go up in poll after poll. Donald Trump's continue to sink. We are seeing more and more reports that Republicans are getting very worried. When you see things like a QAnon sympathizer win in a swing district, beating the incumbent Republican, it gives you a sense that there may be, and I don't know that people expected there would be pickups in the House, but it's very possible. We could see a significant number. I mean, we're at the high end of what would be the potential in terms of pickups in the House, but we could see even more maybe pickups in the House, conceivable. We have a long way to go with this election. I mean, we still have the alien invasion to happen. We still have the lightning to strike Joe Biden. And what else do we have on par? I'm not quite sure what it is.
It's been kind of quiet on nukes lately, so maybe yeah. We can get some of that.
I mean, there's about a half dozen other things I think that are going to happen between now and then that are just going to be insane. But for the time being, the Republicans are having a really tough time running against Joe Biden because in many respects, he's barely there. And this is proving to be a fairly effective strategy on his part. They are really fumbling around. Here is Laura Ingraham trying to articulate the fear that Republicans should have of Joe Biden and therefore go out and vote for Trump. And it is really, this is just, she needs a break, I think, just like I do. Let's play this.
And perhaps my favorite misstep of the week was when Joe Biden stumbled into making a clear and truthful statement on a call with big donors. He said, "I'm going to get rid of the bulk of Trump's $2 trillion tax cut." And a lot of you may not like that. Well, of course, we know that's going to do wonders for all of your 401ks in the midst of a pandemic that caused an unemployment crisis. So I
wait,
recount
pause it
all
for
this
a second.
Because
pause it for a second. What? He's talking to big donors. We're going to roll back the tax cuts, and that's going to impact the 401ks. I don't even understand the logic on her part. She's trying to make the, literally like there's, he's going to roll back the tax cuts for wealthy people.
Yeah. Trickle down.
But I don't like the, how would that implicate the 401ks?
Well, it trickles down.
Yeah, I guess so. All right. I mean, I don't know how, but like that's like trickling sideways. I'm not sure, but let's continue.
Pandemic that caused an unemployment crisis. So I recounted all this tonight because all of these blunders are actually really good news for conservatives, even if some of the underlying news is terrible for the country. But now it's time to communicate all this. If Biden wins, he will support defunding the police, a policy that will lead to lawlessness and disorder. I don't care what he's promising you now. And if Biden wins, every American will be paying more taxes, not to pay down the debt or help the elderly, but to give AOC and company more money to wreak havoc on the country that you love, meaning more anti-American propaganda in the schools, more attacks on the nuclear family, and the big green deal. Well, that's going to be a big new cram down. You'll be sending money to Washington so Pelosi and the squad can commission statues of their new heroes of the left, like, I don't know, Colin Kaepernick and Stacey Abrams.
You know, my favorite part is the, I don't know, like I'm just going to pull this out of my hat and just coincidentally, we're going to have the pictures ready for the graphic. Like, how many people do you think in her audience even know who Stacey Abrams is? It's just a picture of a black woman that she's able to put up. So the pitch is don't vote for Joe Biden because he's going to raise taxes and give the money for a cram down on the Green New Deal to AOC, who's going to erect statues of black people. It's tough to put that on a bumper sticker.
Isn't she supposed to be suppressing the vote? or depressing the vote, I should say.
Yeah, exactly. I think she's got to be as exhausted as I am and just to run out of things. Maybe that's the thing is there's no toehold. I mean, if you've got to go from don't vote for Joe Biden through the machinations that will call for a statue made of Stacey Abrams, I really think that you have not figured out what you're going to run on or run against in this instance. And I mean, I get that Laura Ingraham, it's always low hanging fruit for her to go from, you know, to immediately a fear of a black planet. But man, there's just no sophistication in this. And there's just it's overly sophisticated. It's like a Rube Goldberg machine that they've developed over there. Don't vote for Joe Biden or you're going to get statues of Stacey Abrams. Folks, just a reminder, this program relies on your support. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. We're going to take a quick quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Federico Finkelstein. He's the professor of history at the New School for Social Research and Eugene Lang College on a brief history of fascist lies. Be right back after this. We are back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor of History at the New School for Social Research and Eugene Lang College, author of A Brief History of Fascist Lies, Professor Federico Finkelstein. Welcome to the program.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I want to just start with, and you know, I should say you obviously you write about fascism quite a bit from a historical perspective. Your last book, Fascism to Populism. But give me a sense of what it is, particularly in this topic of fascist lies. What inspired you to write this book? I'm interested, you know, more or less, I guess, like in your personal history of growing up under a, I guess, arguably a fascist regime.
Well, I mean, there are different answers to that question. One dimension, of course, is the biographical one. The first 10 years of my life, I live under a dictatorship that was inspired in a history of fascist ideas. And this dictatorship decided that people that did not think the way the generals wanted them to think were regarded as terrorists, and basically they were kidnapped, tortured, and eventually disappeared, quote unquote, which is to say that these people were killed without anyone knowing about their whereabouts. Now, this dictatorship did in Argentina the dirty war, and by what is interesting is that by in fact the irony or the contradiction was that these dictators were calling members of the opposition terrorists, but in fact they turned the state into a terrorist actor. So that's why historians of Argentina, we talk about the state terrorism. Now, of course, this is very worrisome when you see the same kind of language coming from the White House.
Let's talk about how you started off the your book. You had three quotes. And I have to say, at the very least, this one, you must believe me because I have the habit. It is in the system of my life of always and everywhere saying the truth. That sounds like Donald Trump in many respects. But of course, that was not the Trump quote that you used. That was one from Mussolini. So you had a quote from Trump, Hitler, and Mussolini. What is the difference between the lies that a fascist or would-be fascist tells and just the lies that politicians, broadly speaking, tell?
Yes, I mean, lies are part of politics. As you know, all politicians lie at one point. But the difference, the big difference between a fascist and other types of politicians is not only that they lie more, so here we have a big difference of quantity, but a qualitative difference as well, which is that they either believe their lies, or they believe that ultimately their lies are at the service of a larger transcendental truth, which is the truth that emanates from the cult-like leader. So basically, I mean, and going back to your previous question, I was always interested, both for personal reasons, biographical reasons, as well as you know, scholarly reasons, to understand why people believe in these lies. This is not only about the technique of propaganda, but rather that this propaganda is believed by many. So what people, why people will find meaning in these lies, and eventually they will be willing to die or even kill for them. So there is a kind of a very problematic outcome of this form of lying that we saw in the past with Hitler, Mussolini, and I'm afraid we are seeing now with Donald Trump, which is that by denying fact, by denying science, and denying reality, they change reality and people die as a consequence of this. I mean, from not wearing masks to putting people in concentration camps.
Give us, maybe I should have started with this, but give us a definition of fascism. So when we're talking about a fascist leader and, you know, I mean, there's obviously a leap between, Hitler, Mussolini, and then Trump. But give us a definition of what, of what fascism, what a fascist leader is.
Yes, and by the way, I would like to stress the fact that I don't think Trump is a fascist yet. Trump, and I will go back to this very soon before I will answer your question, but Trump, I mean, he's a populist leader that would like to be in a fascist situation, but he's not. And that depends, of course, on the rest of us to stop that. Now, going back to your question, what is fascism? I mean, fascism is an ideology and a form of government that always stands for putting violence and the glorification of violence, racism, and this type of lies at the center of its politics. And in addition to that, and last but not least, fascism is always a form of dictatorship. So it's an extreme radical extreme right ideology that proposes dictatorship and persecutes those that either behave, think, or simply are different to what the fascists regard as a homogeneous people.
So, I mean, so in the context of Trump, obviously, he's not a dictator. So that is a major element. But he has centered, I think it's fair to say, to a significant extent, race and racism in his leadership. I mean, he ascended in the Republican Party as attacking the, basically calling Barack Obama, the other, as it were, because he was an alien who was not born in this country, shouldn't have been president. And certainly he has nibbled at the edges on promoting violence at various times. And so it's really just sort of, it is his inability to have assumed and to concentrate power. Is that basically what keeps him within the realm of just being a right-wing populist?
Yes, but I mean, I think you are absolutely right also in stressing what makes Trump close to the fascists as well. I mean, in my previous book, From Fascism to Populism, I explained how after 1945, when fascism was defeated, many dictators and many fascists decided or realized that that kind of politics, meaning putting racism at the center of politics, putting violence as at the top, and certainly wishing for dictatorship to be, was toxic in the post-war war. So these dictators, these fascists, as opposed to what the fascists did before, which is, Hitler and Mussolini used democratic means to destroy democracy from within. So these populists, people like Juan Perón in Argentina or Getúlio Vargas in Brazil, after 45, they were dictators, and as opposed to what the fascists did, destroying democracy from within, these dictators destroy the dictatorship from within in order to create new electoral democracies. They carry on key elements of fascism, but also they left behind four key elements. And these elements were the glorification of violence, racism being at the center of politics, as you just mentioned, the technique of lying, which was rather typical of fascism, and of course, dictatorship. Now, that was the history of populism until recently, when people like Trump emerged. Because, I mean, from left to right, people like the Kirchners in Argentina, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, but also right-wingers like Fernando Collor de Mello in Brazil or Silvio Berlusconi in Italy, they kind of, as right-wing as they were, they never put racism at the center. And occasionally, these people were racist, occasionally they were violent, but they were not as, let's say, pro-dictatorship, pro-violence, and pro-racism as the fascists were. Now, what happens is that we see a change in the history of populism because with people like Trump, with people like Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, with people like Viktor Orban in Hungary, or even Narendra Modi in India, what we see is that populism is going back to some key elements that earlier populists, throughout the 20th century, have left behind. So we see a return in populism to key elements of fascism. As you rightly point out, Trump started his campaign with racism. We should remember that he went down his kind of golden stairs in his Trump Tower, and he accused Mexicans of being rapists. I mean, he started with a racist statement. So this used to be toxic in politics. Early populists will see that this was problematic, racist populists like George Wallace never made it into the presidency because of this. And Trump basically showed that that in a way, racism and violence were useful again for populists. Now, the result of that is that then we see a populism that is very close to fascism. It is violence. It is extremely violent in terms of its glorification and eventually in its practice. It is extremely racist. It lies like the fascists, and yet it lacks the dictatorial dimension. So we are not seeing full-fledged fascism yet. And as I said, it depends on the rest of us to stop this. Meaning, Trump would like to be a fascist, but it's unclear he will be able to.
And who knows who's going to adopt his mantle after he is gone. But since you brought up your earlier book, I just want to talk about one thing that from your earlier work that I thought was pretty interesting and relevant here, is that U.S. populism before 1920, in that book, you break it down into three basic eras of populism and fascism and pre-1920, essentially in between 1920 or 1918 and 1945, and then post-45, which you just sort of touched on. Your discussion of populism in that book was a right-wing, a populism that starts amongst farmers and small producers. But when it gains strength and becomes part of the government, there is a reconciliation between these small producers and corporate and finance capital. Can you just talk about that a little bit? Because, you know, the idea of we've just had a left-wing populist movement in this country. I think we have a growing one, but one that played out. It did not win in the Democratic primary. But there are some who are talking about the similarities between left-wing and right-wing populism. And I'm curious as to the extent that they exist, if you could talk about those, but also those key differences.
Yes, I think, in my own approach, I stress the fact that when I say there are authoritarian elements in populism that also include left populism, I'm referring particularly to two ideas. One is the cult of the leader, because in populism and modern populism after 45 carried that from fascism. You see the idea that rather than being a representative of the people, the leader of a populist movement is the one that decides for us. In a way, he's not only, and generally was a he, we know in terms of reaching power, he's not only our representative, but he presents himself as the personification of the people. So thereby, whoever is against the leader is an enemy of the people. Now, the point is that, and I will return to this issue of what are still the key differences between left-wing populism and right-wing populism. But let me refer to the recent Democratic primary, because I don't think someone like Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren were populist. I mean, in the U.S., generally, there is the tendency to conflate popular demands and actors or politicians that respond to those political demands with populism as such. Populism also involves the idea of a leader that is best than the rest of us, and we should just sit in the back seat and do nothing. So I don't think that, you know, people like Warren or Sanders or Ocasio-Cortez, among many, represent that populism. I mean, they are basically, left-wing politicians that represent popular demand. So populism is something else. It is the idea that not only they represent popular demands, but rather they know what popular demands are even better than the rest of us. So there is an idea of, in a way, switching from representation to delegation. We delegate all power on these leaders. Now, but then we see this populism of the left in other situations and countries. For example, the case of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, or the case of the Kirchners in Argentina. These were politicians that generally stood for, sometimes, actually, not all the time, but generally stood for sometimes progressive measures, but at the same time, they were authoritarian and vertical in the sense that they believe whoever was against these ideas that they had was a member of or an enemy of the people. So we don't see at all that in people like Sanders. So I think it's misleading to call him a populist in my own, in terms of my own, you know, interpretation. Meaning I take, I have a very technical and a scholarly notion of populism, of course.
Fair enough.
Now, going back to the differences is that once you have populist, let's say someone very authoritarian populist, which sometimes will be presented as being on the left, such as the former Venezuelan president, Hugo Chavez. So Chavez still, even if he was authoritarian, there were many, let's say there were important differences between, let's say, this sort of left-wing populism and the current right-wing populism. Because the idea, in a way, starts with the same premise. The idea that whoever stands with the leader, that is the people, or those are the people. And whoever is against is the anti-people. So you see this, right?
Yeah.
But in the left-wing version of populism, basically what you have is that this is a place that can change suddenly, and it relies on political identification, on what you think politically. It doesn't matter, you know, what color your skin is or other types of, you know, thoughts or behavior. So it's really a political notion of the people, the authoritarian notion of the people that the leader has, in the sense that if you are with him, you are with the people. If you are against, you are against the people. So in that sense, the current populism of the right, such as Trump or Bolsonaro in Brazil, they adopt a more, if you will, more fascist version of this. Because for them, the people are not only, those citizens that agree with them, but also they conflate that notion of the people, which is rather traditional and rather extended in the history of politics, meaning the people are those that have a certain types of ideas. That's it, right?
Yeah.
But they conflate that with what the fascists did, which is a more an ethnic slash religious notion of the people.
Okay.
So which are the base? Which are the real base? The real people for Trump? Well, they are white Americans that are also Christian. And the same you can see in Hungary, the same you can see in Brazil. And this is not really like the typical populist version of who the people are.
So,
I mean, in a non-populist version, the people are all of us, right? It doesn't matter who, whether we disagree with each other, we are all the people. For populists, let's say before Trump, the people are those that identify with the leader. After Trump or with Trump, the people are those that identify with the leader, but generally the real people are those that are white and Christian. So you go back to this fascist ethno-religious notion of the people. This is a kind of mix, right? The fascists did not have the ideas part. It was only who was Aryan and Christian, okay? Whereas for someone like Trump, he mixes this. People that vote for him, but also, you know, people that are white and Christian.
I see. So when we're talking about... So when we're talking about the left populace, it is almost an authoritarianism that is a function of ideology of some kind, and on the right, it is one that is an authoritarianism that is more identitarian, I guess.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes, exactly.
And
exactly.
So, and what about that concept of, because I your description of populism sounds very synonymous with authoritarianism, that relationship between the followers and the leader is an authoritarian dynamic.
Yes, but populism has a kind of, there are two sides to the populist coin, let's say. Because there is the authoritarianism, but there is something, and let's go back to this idea that populists after 1945 left behind key elements of authoritarianism and fascism. So there are like authoritarian ideas, but also they are mixed, conflicted, but also mixed. They are a hybrid because they are mixed with democratic ones. So who is the one that rules? The person that is voted. And that's why populists are obsessed with elections. And that's why in the history of populism, I mean, the idea is that you don't have, let's say, a pluralistic idea of the people or who are the majority. So the people become only the majority that agrees with the leader. The minorities in populism, they are delegitimized. They don't have legitimacy because they are not the real people. Now, nothing happens to them in a populist democracy. They are symbolically demonized, but nothing happens. They are not persecuted, and they still have the ability to vote against the leader. Now the leader says, you don't like me, vote me out. The majority voted for me, so if you don't like me, vote me out. If you lose, then you are not the people, but you will keep your rights. Whereas in fascism, there is no thing like that, in the sense that minorities are imprisoned, exiled, and eventually killed. So there is no place for the minority in fascism or dictatorship. And in the populist, let's say, a way of authoritarianism, what you have is a mix. There are, let's say, authoritarian, basically the language is authoritarian, which is bad enough, but the practice is not. And that's why I'm so concerned about someone like Trump, because what you see is that he goes beyond the language. He seems to go back to, you know, to things which were not used, which were not typical of populism, but rather typical of fascism. So we have in Trump a new hybrid, in a way, a mix not only of populism and democracy, but a mix of those two with fascism again.
Is it a hybrid, or are we simply, or is it, or you know, from a conceptual standpoint, are we looking at a hybrid, or are we looking at a matter of degree, that you're moving along a spectrum and that you need to go through this part of, you know, to get from place A to place B, or, you know, or Z, you're going through some of those other letters in the alphabet. And that's what, in some sense, that's what we're doing. I mean, Trump may not be able to get all the way, but we're heading down a certain path.
Certainly. And as an historian, I really like the way you put it, because this is a process. So at this point, it's a hybrid, but it's difficult to see which is the end point. But we see that there has been a deterioration of democracy in this country, and Trump's authoritarianism has increased over the years, over days even. So, and certainly, radicalized by the current pandemic and his ability to downplay important institutions of the state, appropriating them, militarizing politics, and all the things that your listeners know about what the president is doing. So, yes, this is a... I mean, we see that he has been trying. We don't see the end point. Hopefully, the end point will be, him losing in elections. But we see that he has been trying to, in a way, depart from, let's say, the more democratic dimensions of populism, and even to some extent depart from some key populist dimensions to turn into a more dictatorial or even fascist situation. He has not been able to do so. And as I said, hopefully he will not be able to do so. So it's hard to say historically whether Trump is a fascist in the making, because we don't know what is going to happen. Historians, we always have hindsight and we know what is going to happen. At this point, it's a matter of speculation. But certainly we can say, and I can say this as an expert on both fascism and populism, that what we see is that here you have a populist that is really making the populist dimension, certainly the democratic ones, and trying to approach fascism or dictatorship with a fast pace. Again, there are a lot of, steps that he will need to take, and I'm not so sure the rest of us will allow him to do so.
Yeah, I want to get to that part about how we prevent that. But I also want to just zero in, and then I want to get into, more about the specifics about the dynamic of lies. But before we do, this concept of fascism coming, via an individual, I want to read a quote to you, because, what you talk about in terms of lies, and we'll get there in a moment. This quote stuck with me, in part because the journalist who was expressed to had imparted it to me years ago. But it is he was talking to an aide of the president, and he was told that the journalist was told that guys like me, not me personally, but this is the journalist, are in what we call the reality-based community, which he defined as people who believe that solutions emerge from your judicious study of discernible reality. That's not the way the world really works anymore, he continued. We're an empire now. When we act, we create our own reality. And while you're studying that reality judiciously, as you will, we'll act again, creating other new realities, which you can study too. That's how things sort out. We're history's actors. And you, all of you, will be left just to study what we do. You write that the lies that are being told by a fascist are the reason why their followers are immune from those lies being disproved is because they are speaking towards a greater truth that is like normative and aspirational. That quote was from the George W. Bush administration. So I wonder if there isn't a like very fertile ground that Donald Trump is working with that he is tilling more than seeding.
Yes, I mean, that is an important quote. Like, if you take this quote individually or out of its context, I will say it ranks very high in the fascist scale. Now, the question, of course, regarding the Bush administration is to what extent they were willing to go all the way in these beliefs, you know, in their own lives. And to me, the impression that I have is that they were more traditional in the way they approach life, more hypocritical, if you will, someone like Dick Cheney and so on. Whereas what I see here, of course, there is a, you know, the result of the statement like that, and you know, were very consequential. But even then, you didn't see this demonization of the press. And here, I mean, the press is very important because it is through the press, through journalists, that we citizens are able to gather facts in order to, you know, to make judgments about reality. So my point is, like, if you compare, you know, the, not only, you know, if you put the statement in its context, as wild, as radical as it was then, I think it looks mild vis-a-vis what's going on right now.
Right.
And you know, and the best example of this is this, you know, one of the, you know, huge lies of Trumpism, which is the idea that you don't need to wear a mask. And to me, that is the perfect example. And I talk about this in the book. That is kind of out of the fascist playbook. And in the sense that what is a better example that this belief in lies that eventually can be lethal than the president's own refusal to wear a mask, which is kind of dangerous. So the point is that, you know, if we want proof that Trump believes the stuff he says, well, this is a perfect example because he's putting himself in danger. You know, science will tell us, because of not wearing a mask and, you know, in terms of his interactions with people and even huge crowds. So that's even risky for himself, but he believes in this. And that's, this goes back to other examples, I mean, which were more consequential, perhaps in terms of, you know, the horrible outcomes that they provided, such as the Holocaust. Or Hitler's war. I mean, Hitler himself thought that Nazism was so formidable that it didn't matter, you know, in terms of military numbers. I mean, which were the chances? He was sure that they would win a war on all fronts against the Russians and the Americans, and he was willing to risk everything, including his own life, for that, and he did. So you might say, okay, sometimes this kind of belief in lies is certainly more problematic than hypocritical politicians, because of hypocritical politicians at some point will stop. And I think even the Bush administration somehow stopped its unchecked wars.
Yeah.
And here, certainly in fascism, you don't see that. They go to the end. And they sacrifice even themselves for the lies. And the bad part, of course, is that they sacrifice many other innocent lives along the way. And we see something similar, or let's say we see many parallels with what's going on with the coronavirus in this country.
So the lies of a Bush administration are tactical on some level. Although, you know, that quote to me sounds like, you know, there's a distinct rejection of, you know, material intangible reality. But the lies of a fascistic leader are existential on some level. And well, but I mean, when you describe someone who is asserting a truth that is demonstrably false, and they believe that they have a more direct line to a hidden truth, which certainly sounds like Donald Trump, but it also sounds like a madman, like someone. I mean, that's almost like the definition of someone who is clinically deluded.
I mean, in the sense that it is you know, in every psychotic, you see an attempt to deny and escape from reality. Now, but to me, I argue against that idea in the book, in the sense that, I mean, I'm not that interested about whether, you know, Trump is clinically deranged, because to me, I'm interested in the politics of this.
Right.
Which is to say that these are lies that are believed by many, and the leader believes that he personifies the truth. He personifies the truth because he is part of a cult. He's part of a political religion where he's a godlike figure. Hitler saw that like that. And I think we see instances of this in Trump as well. Now, the point is that what do the fascists do when reality does not conform to their lies? Because this is a risky, the kind of, you know, the kind of very dangerous dimension of this.
Yes, I mean, because that to me yeah, sounds like you're describing the Republican National Convention that's going to take place in a month or so.
Yes, I agree. It's a perfect example of you know, extremists believing the lies of the leader. But now the problem is that this affects, you know, it might affect the entire city of Jacksonville and the rest of us.
Well, yes, we're seeing it in Arizona. We're seeing it in Florida. We're seeing it in Texas right now. Yeah.
I mean, the best example of this, I mean, a horrible example, by the way, is that, you know, the Nazis, one of the big, you know, the big lies of the Nazis was that Jews were dirty and they spread disease. This was a big, big lie. So let's say a non-fascist person would say, yeah, well, this cannot be proven by reality. It means then that it might be false. So the fascists did not think that because Hitler said so. And basically what they did, as you know, is turn reality into a lie. But in a way, reality changed and the lie became a reality. What I mean, let me be explicit about this. So Jews were certainly not dirty and certainly did not spread disease. But the Nazis created artificial conditions in ghettos and concentration camps where, you know, with horrible unsanitary conditions, with, you know, lack of food, violence, and so on and so forth, Jews eventually in concentration camps and ghettos became dirty and spread disease. So the fascists eventually would say, you see, Hitler was right because Jews are dirty and spread disease. But this was based on the fascist successful attempt to turn a lie into reality.
I mean, that...
Now, that, yeah, go ahead.
Well, that actually is, I think, that example is what inspired my recalling this quote, frankly, which was, you know, you look at the situation as it is, and we create our own reality, and that's exactly what was done there.
Yes, and the quote, I mean, in my book you can find, you know, from the 1920s and 30s, some fascists arguing similar things. I mean, I have, for example, an Argentine fascist in the book, famous fascist Leopoldo Lugones said, it's not that we don't believe in empirical truth, but we believe in a truth that transcends and is more important than empirical truth. And this truth is absolute, it's the truth of a religion, and it's a truth which is based on faith. Not in faith in the leader. It's not based on data. So here, I mean, the paradox here, or the, you know, one contradiction here is that what fascists, and I will add Trumpists, understand as the truth, the rest of us, we have to regard it as a lie because it cannot be demonstrated. In fact, it is, you know, reality demonstrates against its tenets or its axioms. So the idea that masks are not useful against the virus. Well, that's the idea. That's a lie.
Right.
So this is how it works. I was, in my 7 books on fascists, dictators, and populists. The key issue for me is not only how it works, but why people believe in this. What is the mechanism that allows people or prompts people to believe in this? And one of them is the belief in a leader that knows it all.
And it's just easier to sort of outsource those questions, right? I mean, this is I think, you know, studies of orthodox practice of religion is a similar dynamic where people just modernity or whatever the era that they're living in, it's much easier to sort of outsource, like, you know, as many questions and answers to those questions as you can. What do I wear today? Well, one of the benefits of practicing a highly orthodox religion is that that answers, you know, there for you before you wake up. What do I eat? That's already there. What don't I eat? That's already there for you. I mean, these are questions. It gives you a very rigid guidebook on how to live your life.
Yes, I mean, but here the big problem is that this fanatic way of being religious is displaced into politics, and thereby it becomes violent and lethal, because what used to belong to the sphere of religion now is part, is the alpha and omega of politics, is the center of politics. And this is, this is how it works. So basically what you have is a leader that believes himself to be a god or a god-like figure, and he believes his followers should follow him accordingly. So you have this displacement of religion into the political sphere, and the result and the outcome is intolerance. Because, I mean, how can you argue against one's own faith? This is not demonstrable. It's a matter of it's a matter of belief, not of demonstration. But when this is applied to politics, it's very problematic, because it leaves the rest of us as being unfaithful.
To what extent, in your study of fascism, is fascism a function of capitalism and the commensurate economic immiseration that occurs within a capitalist system?
Well, I mean, fascism, in the beginning, many people believed that fascism was just a branch of capitalism. And history demonstrated that it's much more complicated than that, because fascism works well with capitalism. Certainly, fascism is always a right-wing ideology and is never against capitalism. But it also, it has its own imperatives. So sometimes, eventually, German capitalists did not want the destruction of Germany that Hitler provided, eventually. But they work really well, for some time. So the big mistake, I think, by conservatives and even capitalists, is to believe that they can ride a horse. That in a way, that is the wrong, that is mistaken. So fascism worked well with capitalism until capitalism, or let's say capitalist or economic imperatives, became a problem. As you know, instead of, using trains to help the war economy, Nazis decided to use those trains to kill Jews.
Right.
And this was not based on a capitalist logic. Now, there is another element here, another layer, which is equally problematic. Let's say, in the same way that they model themselves after capitalism, because the Nazis, particularly when they killed. But they changed, they reformulated the entire thing, because if in Fordism or Taylorism, what you had, in a capitalist line of production was producing, obviously, wealth and a product, what the Nazis did is create a kind of line of production to produce death, not surplus value or not profit. So the profit for the Nazis eventually was death. Their priority was to kill, not to earn money. If they could earn money along the way, great.
Okay, and so that dynamic of the capitalists, thinking they can ride that horse, and the fascists in their extreme version are not seeking, a profit. Are the circumstances of capitalism sometimes giving birth to the horse, as it were?
An excellent historian of fascism, Jeff Ely, also an historian of the left, he has a really good idea about this, that there are certain political and economic situations that, at least in the 1920s, they were fascist-producing situations, let's say. Obviously, if you have a political crisis coupled with an economic crisis, you had this, let's say you have an entry point or a pathway for this kind of magical solutions to very complex problems. So in a way, fascism thrives on crisis, certainly.
Fair enough.
But on the other hand, but on the other hand, if you focus on Trump, the economic situation wasn't that bad, but he was, in a way, faking the situation of an economic situation. He denounced an economic crisis which was not there. So here we return to the issue of lies. In a way, it doesn't matter as much whether you have an actual political crisis or an actual economic crisis, but whether lies about those things, whether these lies are believed.
It's a fascinating look at something that you know, I got to say, kudos on the timing. I wish I couldn't say that, but yeah, the timing.
Me too.
Well, the book is A Brief History of Fascist Lies, Federico Finkelstein. We will put that we will put a link to that book at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
All right, folks, we're going to head into the fun half of the program in a moment. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. By becoming a member, you support the live show and we give you extra content every day, almost every day. Next week, we're going to be on vacation. We're going to give you brand new interviews. Really some interesting, very interesting interviews. I don't know, we may throw in some of the archive stuff too. But certainly on the vast majority of days, we give you extra content for you to enjoy. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. If you do not have the finances to become a member, but you want the extra content, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Put in membership in the subject line and give it some time. We will get to it. I promise you, we will get to it. Sometimes it feels like an eternity, but we will definitely get there for you. And don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. We have our merch. Our merch has gone crazy.
I'm losing it, bro.
The I'm losing it, bro line of Majority Report t-shirts have been blockbuster pre-orders. This, of course, was a, well, I don't know if it was a brainchild. What am I thinking of? Brainchild? What is that? Is it brainchild? Is that the right word? Sometimes you say words like that and that sounds...
Yeah, it's weird language, but I think that is the word you're thinking of.
It is. Brainchild of John Benjamin. In fact, it wasn't even really a brainchild. It was really more of like a brain spasm.
That seems like a 90s marketing term, brainchild.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's just sometimes you say words and then you like, do people really say that? It was actually really more of a brain spasm of John Benjamin's. And he just...
I'm losing it, bro.
He's having troubles. And we put it on a t-shirt and now you can buy it. And all the proceeds of that t-shirt go to Skid Row Trust, which is an organization that supports the unhoused in Los Angeles. So every dollar of profit there goes to skidrow.org, I think it is, but it's the Skid Row Trust. So you can check that out. Also, we have other things at the Majority Report. Remember, the masks, all the proceeds of the masks go to the Pacific Northwest Immigration Center. So those masks as well. And we have t-shirts. I keep meaning to wear some swag. That was merchandise, but we will get there eventually. Also, the AM Quickie, you can sign up for that at amquickie.com. Joining us for the fun half, Bill Fletcher was on your show this week.
Bill Fletcher Jr., great guest, and good to see you, Sam.
Nice to see you, Michael. Are you graduating?
Graduate.
Graduate. Is that like you have the purple like robe? Oh, I okay. That there was a sash that would signify that you had gotten your master's degree. I believe.
Yes.
If I'm not mistaken, it is the season. Yeah.
It is the season. If only it were so. Bill Fletcher Jr. was the guest. We talked about everything from what is building a 21st century labor movement actually look like. Different periods of Reconstruction and how it relates to the Trump agenda, and also some of the themes in Nancy McLean's Democracy in Chains book, which I like to periodically recommend people read that book.
Nancy was right.
Nancy was completely right. And the distinction that if you're talking about Trump, you know, if you're using this fascist terminology to compare Trump to like something from Europe, that's pretty ahistorical and silly. But if you recognize that America has absolutely something that could be situated as a fascist tradition, very much organic to this country, it flows right out of that. And that's also how you can understand how Mitch McConnell runs the Senate. We also talked about saving the post office and the post game. I guess I had a lot of hot takes. I had to have my own spin on this whole right-wing populism drama. Jesus Christ, actually listened to Sam Harris's entire BLM response, which
awful.
Wowza.
Truly awful.
Really?
No, I was saying in the segment that, you know, for better, I mean, I've changed some of the things that I think in the last couple of years. Some of my, you know, like, and just going in and not having listened or read anything by Sam Harris ever since I finished my book and just being like, has anything been upgraded? No.
Nothing.
I mean, literally nothing. It's
is Sam Harris as popular as he was before? He doesn't seem to be in the conversation as much.
No, he's not. But I actually, it's an interesting conversation in general to me because I just feel like we're so deep into everybody's into their own silo that it like, because, you know, it's like, no, he's nowhere near in the conversation that he was, but he still has, you know, a million followers.
Right.
He still has a ton of people listening to him. He still has well-selling books. So when I think about it, Rogan has a mass audience. Although, again, even he, like, we'll see how that changes when he goes to Spotify.
Right.
There's a lot of people like Russell Brand. I keep tabbing on Russell Brand. And, of course, like, he's got a huge audience. But I don't. You got to seek him out. And it just seems to me that that's kind of like increasingly true of like everybody.
Yeah,
I guess so. But I have a feeling that like, you know, I think Harris was.
No, his brand's gone down.
He was in the conversation more because he was because of the foil that he had. Right. Like he could say like you could do, you know, during the Obama years, like you could.
Yeah.
You know, he could be Obama adjacent, but still introduce these right wing ideas that, you know, were edgy. But now it's just like, well, we've now taken your ideas to their proper conclusion. And it's Laura Ingraham.
Right. Well, actually, that was what Matt said. Matt was like, he's gearing up for the Biden era. And I think there's some truth to that.
Right. Winding up. Like, we're going to have, they're tearing down the statues. And
he's not into all this. And no, he's into like the most. Like,
he's stop resisting arrest. Literally.
Black Lives Matter should be training people to stop resisting arrest. And then, you know, I won't go into it too much, but it's classic Sam because there's a lot of like, of course we need police reform. And of course we need to do stuff about the war on drugs. Here's one example of a police killing that is really unjustifiable and this person should get charged with murder. Now I want to debate and get into a very bizarre dispute on the merits of the Eric Garner case as an example. And also cops don't get enough training. They don't know how to use their guns properly and stuff, which again, it's like, you know, every available piece of evidence we have is that cops are overtrained when it comes to inflicting violence on people and undertrained when it comes to de-escalating. And
I think that it is the case that they probably don't get certainly they don't get as much training with their guns as you would imagine. But I would also argue that you could make them all sharpshooters, that they could hit a soda can from, 150 yards away, and it wouldn't change a single thing.
It wouldn't change the mentality. But there's that killology school that a lot of people have reported on. I mean, they do, to the extent they do get training and resources are put, it is into martial application. So I guess the notion that, like,
Acculturated to this notion that they are going into war, and I'm not convinced that making them better sharpshooters I have the ability to plug somebody in the knee as opposed to aiming for their chest or something is going to make any difference whatsoever.
Precisely.
That's the one beautiful thing about Sam Harris that I think is like, I totally agree with you, except for these material points that completely change the whole spirit of that agreement.
Yeah, precisely. Exactly.
But if I keep it vague enough, if I keep it vague enough and stay on this level and then go dig down into the minutia, which supposedly provides a greater explanation and a negation of that agreement, but I don't explicitly say that, then I can say that you are putting words in my mouth.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. I have to say on the flip side that I enjoyed, maybe because it's annoyed me that people have been trying to pressure me to say this slogan, which I just, to me right now, it's just, there isn't much meaning to the slogan. So in the conversation with Bill Fletcher Jr., when we were talking about defund the police and capitalist policing and the reforms that could be done today, that could be significant. And then the deeper stuff that would have to require systemic economic change. He was like, and I say defund because we're not abolishing cops. There's always going to be some type of cop. And then he was like, told a pretty traumatic personal story, which you could listen to about his daughter. And he was just like, what am I going to do? Call up Ghostbusters on this guy? Or argue politics with him.
Well, we would have
like, he's like, there's going to be a function, whether we call it that or not, of policing. And I just, especially in the context, I mean, Bill Fletcher is a serious scholar and radical. And I appreciated that demand to really think with precision about this stuff. So we actually can accomplish things because slogans can turn into anything.
Well, defund also polls poorly, actually. But
defund, definitely. Yes.
Reinvest or disinvest and reinvest,
but whatever.
I think there's been a lot gained and it's bringing people out into the streets and that's going to have much more efficacy anyways. All right. We got to take a break and head into the fun half in a moment. But also, I just want to remind you, check out Nomiki's show. You can find the Patreon.com, The Nomiki Show, and also on YouTube.com/ The Nomiki Show, and check out The Antifada. Jamie's got a whole slate of things going on at The Antifada, and as well as her vampire castle, talking about vampires. Matt, what's happening on Literary Hangover's Twitch stream?
Twitch.tv/literary hangover. I've been hitting the high seas and learning about the revolutionary Atlantic. Also, there will be a new episode for patrons coming up, the third part of my essay or episode on George Orwell's Lion and the Unicorn. And I'll release the first two parts publicly finally Saturday then, too. So some new podcast content coming from Literary Hangover.
All right. And we have a special today on our transition into the fun half. And who did this?
This is Slug McBlob.
Slug McBob.
McBlob.
The voice sounds familiar to me a little bit, but I don't know if it's him. I mean, it's obviously Slug McBlob, but I don't know who that is. But I don't know where this came from, but it's I think it's pretty amazing. It's also, I mean, we're going to play in the fun half, the Mario Brothers like mashup of this show and Mario Brothers. I don't know what to tell you.
I just saw that before we went on, and I won't be spoiling anything, but the noise that Dave Rubin makes when you knock them out. It's the funniest.
Well, I don't know if we're going to get to that level, but.
Oh, my God. That was what made, I mean, the whole thing is great. It's very creative, but that was, I was dying at that.
I just saw this one, too. We're going to do this. We'll see you in the fun half, 646-257-3920. Here it is, folks. You may want to stick around for this.
He's a man with a PhD, and you will see such a ride with you. Because you demand his way of sin. Don't go in. The day of Big Mama Boys has passed. Alpha males are taking a trophist. For the beta male knows when he has his hands. So kiss the dish from Mr. Gorka Jigger. He's a man with a bad intent. Looks like David Brent. Check his words, he'll bore in your ear. But his lies can't disguise what you fear. For the data mail knows when he has his hand. It's the kiss of the dish. From Mr. Gorka Jigger. He's a man with a big fat head. Eats lots of bread. He only eats bread. So much bread. So much better.